Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Ashkan Kazarian. Don't put dirt on net neutrality's grave just yet. The Congressional Review Act is the law by which Republican Congress and Trump administration have recently eliminated 14 of President Obama's midnight regulations by passing laws called resolutions of disapproval. But Democrats just recently rediscovered their love for the CRA, trying to use it to bring back the Obama-era net neutrality regulations. To discuss the CRA, I have the privilege of hosting Gigi Zahn, a distinguished fellow at the Georgetown Law Institute for Technology Law and Policy, a Mozilla fellow, and a counselor to the former chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, who has passed the net neutrality regulations in 2015. Also, we're joined by El Comandante of Tech Freedom, Baron Zocca.
Thanks for having me.
So, Baron, do you want to give us a brief recap of what CRA is and how it works?
So it's the Congressional Review Act. It was one of the things that the House Republicans back under the Contract for America that they passed in the mid-90s. And it's a procedure for disapproving of a major rule undertaken by an administrative agency. So it has two effects. It undoes that thing, whatever that rule is, and it precludes the agency from doing anything substantially similar. So as we discussed last time, it's been used fairly rarely and until last year. So Republicans last year did pass 15 CRAs to undo Obama-era regulatory actions. But before that, it had really only successfully been used once. So now this CRA that's being discussed, it's not quite ripe yet because it can't actually move until the Restoring Internet Freedom Order that the FCC published last year has actually been both published in the Federal Register and sent to Congress in a report. So once that happens, the CRA will go before the Senate Commerce Committee, and the Senate Commerce Committee has 20 days to move on that item. If they don't vote on it, if they don't send it to the floor, it can be discharged from the committee with 30 signatures. And right now there are 50 senators, including Senator Susan Collins, a Republican, who have signed on to that discharge petition, which means that it will be discharged from the committee. But there's a little confusion here. Most people think that forces a floor vote. What the CRA actually says is that that discharge petition requires the item to be put on the Senate calendar. And the Senate calendar is full of things that will never see the light of day. So there are currently 295 items on there, that some of them have been on there for a year and a half. And it's ultimately up to the Senate Majority Leader, Senator McConnell, to decide whether he wants to allow a floor vote. But that's the basic procedure. And again, it would roll back the Ajit Pai Restoring Internet Freedom Order and would effectively both reinstate the 2015 Open Internet Order and also lock that in forever until Congress acted otherwise. The FCC would not be able to undo that, which means that the FCC would have reclassified broadband as a Title II service, would be able to use that to regulate broadband as well as Section 706. And that would be, again, permanent until Congress decides to change that.
Gigi, so you were one of the architects of the Open Internet Order. What are your thoughts on the CRA and this whole initiative?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. This is a privilege, and Baron and I have been friends for years. And even though we tend to disagree on broadband policy, we actually agree on a lot of internet policy, and I respect his opinion greatly, and also the way he expresses his opinion, which is not a small thing in these days of tribalism. So obviously,
well, right back at you.
Thanks. So obviously, we think that Chairman Pai's and the FCC's action in not only repealing the 2015 net neutrality rules, but in basically abdicating the FCC's role in protecting consumers and competition when it comes to the broadband market was a serious legal and policy error. And, you know, we are hopefully later going to talk a little bit about, you know, this is not just a congressional track that we're on. We're also on a judicial track. But let me get back to the congressional track. The CRA is the quickest and best way to get back to the 2015 rules and the FCC's oversight rule, both of which I think across the board, across parties, very, very popular with the American people. They want strong rules. They're not happy with the choices they have in broadband. They're not happy with the prices they pay for broadband. And I believe they believe that there should be a cop on the beat. So the CRA is the best way to get us back to where we were before. It's not the length and cost of litigation. You know, we can have a conversation about whether there should be a long-term fix, and Barron and I might have agreement on the process, if not so much on the substance. But right now, the American people want rules that protect an open internet, and this is the best and easiest way to get them.
You know what this reminds me of changing the rules to affirm judges, and then the other party coming into power and flipping that and using it against the other party. So it's interesting how congressional rules are sometimes very boring. You know, I bet most of our listeners didn't know what a CRA was until it got into the news recently. But now it's such a powerful tool that might be used. Barron, what do you think about the possibility of CRA passing?
Well, as I said, even if there were to be 51 senators, you would need, of course, 51 to actually win a floor vote, because the vice president will cast the deciding vote. There's a little bit of a wild card here, because there are, of course, two Republican senators who are very ill. And theoretically, it's possible that there might be a vacancy. So that's possible. But generally speaking, you need 51. And I don't think that's likely to happen. There are some senators, at least Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, who has said that he's still trying to make up his mind. So it's theoretically possible. I don't think it's very likely. And even if it did somehow get to 51, and if Senator McConnell did somehow decide to allow a floor vote, which really would be pretty unusual. There's only been one circumstance like this where the CRA was used when the Senate was under the same control as the White House. That was back in 2003, where there was a Democratic bill to undo the FCC's media ownership rules. And that ultimately, the Senate Majority Leader did, even though he didn't support it, he did allow a vote on it. And it's worth noting that there were 55 votes for it. 12 of those were Republicans. So that was, it's pretty different from today. It wasn't just one or two Republicans who wanted to vote on it. It was a pretty significant percentage of the Senate Republican caucus. I don't think that's a really direct precedent. Now, you could say McConnell should still allow a vote, and he might. And I'm not necessarily against that. I think in some ways, having a vote, certainly if the vote were to fail, might be the best way to close this chapter, because I think ultimately we should be talking about legislation, substantive legislation, and I think the CRA is a distraction from that. But to answer your question, it's first of all, it's probably not likely to get to 51. Even if it does, McConnell's not likely to allow a vote. It's not going to pass the House, and the president's already said he's going to veto it. So at most, this is a big political storm that attracts a lot of attention. Burger King makes some more ads. You know, who knows? Maybe Five Guys gets involved, but it's not ultimately going to change anything. But there is a way for Congress to do that, and that is legislation. And that has nearly happened several times, or has come. We've had some bipartisan agreement in the past. There have been bills on both sides. That's where we should be focusing our attention.
So, but on the substance, you don't agree with the bill, with CRA as it stands right now?
Yeah, and let me explain why. So I ultimately think that we should codify net neutrality principles into law. And I think that the core of that is not controversial. Republicans have supported that idea since Michael Powell and Kevin Martin were FCC chairman. There were three Republican bills in 2006 that allowed that to happen in one way or another. The policy differences are relatively small. The big difference is and always has been about the scope of the FCC's authority over the internet. And I fundamentally, the reason that Tech Freedom joined the lawsuit against the FCC over the last 2 years was fundamentally about that legal authority. And my fundamental concern with the CRA is it locks in forever the idea that the FCC is going to regulate the internet under the standards developed for railroads in the 1880s. Of course, people will say, well, it's only Title II light. They won't use all of Title II. But that's an illusory promise. They've simply forborne from the most parts of it, but they can change their minds on that at any time. And they didn't forbear from. They did apply in the 2015 order. The heart of Title II, which is rate regulations, 201B, 202A of the Communications Act, those are essentially the Interstate Commerce Act of 1888. And that's still on the table if the CRA passes, and it's on the table forever. It's locked in. That's why the CRA is a bad idea.
We're not putting dirt on Netan Chowdhury's grave yet because there's also a lot of action in the courts, as Gigi mentioned earlier, right, Gigi? So where Tech Freedom is suing FCC, I know other people are suing FCC. Do you mind talking about that?
I don't, but I need to address some of the things that Barron talked about the possibility for the CRA to succeed, about legislation in the future, and then I'll talk a little bit about the litigation. So I think it's important for people to know that we are in very early days of the CRA. I mean, the fact that we have 50 sponsors to move this thing forward in the Senate a month after the FCC voted is really, nobody expected it. I mean, if you talk to anybody who works in this space on the public interest side that I work on in the Senate, nobody expected it. It's really been a whirlwind. And as Barron said before, the procedural machinations over the CRA don't start until the rule is finalized. And we have, so that's going to be either when the rule is published in the Federal Register or when the FCC delivers the rule to Congress, whichever is later. So I've been hearing rumors that possibly Federal Register publication is the end of February, maybe it's later. But we're actually talking about the process not even starting for another month or two. It could even be longer. I have no idea whether Chairman Pai thinks it behooves the agency to wait or not to wait. I would think it would behoove him to move quicker, but he may, you know, even if he moves quicker, this conversation is going to happen through the summer, not far from the election. Go ahead.
And to note here, it's not up to Pai. I mean, remember, this is up to the Office of Management and Budget because they're the ones that have to complete the Paperwork Reduction Act, the Small Business Impact Statement. I don't think Pai really has any direct control now over what happens.
Okay, a correction there. Okay, so it's actually on two separate tracks. This is stuff that I've been learning about myself. The Paperwork Reduction Act approval by OMB actually doesn't impact the final publication. It does impact the effectiveness and the date of the effectiveness of the rule. I just learned about this week. Okay, so publication in the Federal Register without the OMB approval, right? The publication of the summary, which the FCC said would trigger judicial review and would also trigger congressional review under the Congressional Review Act, that can happen sooner than the OMB paperwork approval, which frankly could take, in Jenikowski's time, took, 11 months. So they're actually on two separate tracks. It's so, everything here is so arcane, isn't it? But regardless of what the track is, we're talking about having a debate in an election year through the summer and possibly even beyond. So that's something that, you know, I think makes some people nervous because now you've got Burger King weighing in. Maybe all of a sudden this actually becomes an issue on which people vote. So it's very early days. Look, a week ago, there are only 80 sponsors in the House. A week later, there's 111. So I think the groups that I work with feel pretty confident we'll get 51 and maybe we'll get 55. A veto-proof majority, that's going to be tough. All right? But even to get this far in the Senate, as far as I'm concerned, is a victory, right? Because part of this is about getting the rules back, but part of this is building a constituency for a strong open internet and strong oversight and people voting on these issues. So I don't think falling short is a loss.
So this kind of virtue signaling, do you think, Barron, it would matter in the long run?
Well, I think Gigi's right that's what this is really in large part about. I mean, even people who think that they're not likely to win in Congress are using this as a vehicle to, as she said, build a constituency. I don't really think we should be using arcane legal issues about the FCC's authority to regulate the internet as a way of building a political base. But even if you disagreed with that, it's important to note here that there's an opportunity cost. That the longer this fight goes on, the more likely we are to repeat what happened in 2006, 2010, and 2014 and 15, where in each of those three time periods, there was a window for crafting legislation that could actually resolve this issue. And each time that window closed, and sometimes it was Republicans who decided that they would be better off waiting, and sometimes it was Democrats. And I'm tired of playing that game. I mean, frankly, I have better things to do. I'm sure Gigi has better things to do with her life. We should be talking about things like broadband deployment and moving on to other issues. And those things, frankly, are paralyzed until this issue gets resolved. So as I see it, there's a window right now in the spring that where you know, Gigi's got a point. We've got Republicans' attention. And the CRA, in a sense, is useful in that it sort of forces Congress to focus on this issue finally. I'd like to take advantage of that and say, okay, fine. Let's dust off the proposals that have attracted bipartisan support in the past. Let's look at the Waxman bill from 2010, which was updated as the Thune proposal in 2014 and 15. Marsha Blackburn has reintroduced that minus a ban on paid prioritization. So you don't have to agree with all of the details of that, but it's now been 7 years since Democrats have put forward a legislative proposal. I think this is the time for both sides to sit down and hammer this out. And my concern is that if both sides play politics, which of course Republicans have done too, if both sides decide to play politics with this, we miss the window again, and this issue just kicks down the road to maybe 2019, maybe 2020. Of course, then it's a presidential year. Then we probably get the next Democratic administration just reasserting this power over the internet. The next Republican administration undoes it. We could be going around and around on this literally for decades.
And we're asking lawmakers, please don't do this to Barron. I don't think he can. I don't think he can do five more years of.
Well, look, first of all, and the other point I wanted to make about bringing it to the floor is that McConnell and Schumer have a lot of things to negotiate on, right? So we shouldn't be looking at this necessarily. Again, I'm not going to say it's not going to be a challenge to get McConnell to bring it to the floor, right? And I think Chairman Pai has a very good relationship with him, but there's a lot of horse trading between the two of them. And I will tell you that, at least for the Democrats, this is a core issue. And, you know, we've been told this. This is an issue for the base. This is an issue they care about. This is an issue that they want to run on. So they're going to do their damnedest to get this thing to the floor. So I'm not ready. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, it's going to be easy. All right. But I'm also not ready to write the death warrant for the CRA. And I think the tech press has been way too eager to do that. This is a thing. Now, if we want to have a conversation about, you know, legislation in the future, I'm happy to have that conversation, but I'm not going to say don't do the CRA. I think the CRA actually is, and pushing the CRA and making members get on the record about voting for or against net neutrality is a necessary predicate to having good legislation. Because right now, what's being offered, from my perspective, and I would say the perspective of the entire public interest community, is not even close to what it's got to be. And I also don't. I have a concern about just focusing on net neutrality. I mean, there are a world of issues that I'm concerned about that are related to net neutrality but aren't necessarily. So things like Anna Eshoo's Dig Once bill, right? So that's an infrastructure bill to make sure that, you know, every time a road is dug up, there's a conduit for fiber. I'm concerned about the state preemption of community broadband. I'm concerned about privacy, and not just from the ISPs, but also from the online community. So, you know, I think I am, and some of my community are ready to talk about, okay, what is the broadband world we want to live in? And why just focus, and I'm not saying it's a small issue, because it's obviously huge, and it implicates more than no throttling, no blocking, no paid prioritization. It implicates FCC oversight. But why aren't we talking about something bigger? Why aren't we talking about a competitive market where, you know, instead of having one or two internet service providers in a market, why aren't we talking about local communities trying to decide their own broadband futures? Why aren't we talking about privacy? You know, there's a lot of things that I would like to talk about if we are going to talk about legislation going forward. I think just focusing just on net neutrality is actually, at this stage of the game, not really enough. And it's been interesting to see the debates in the states, because a lot of what's going on now, in fact, I've got a template of all the states now that have introduced either executive orders or legislation, or going to introduce legislation on net neutrality, is that some of them are considering bringing privacy both broadband for broadband and online services into those bills. Some are thinking about using it as a way to preempt their restrictions on community broadband. So I think the American people are not just looking at this as one issue. They're looking at it as a broadband ecosystem, and frankly, I would say even broader, an internet ecosystem that is not serving their needs. So maybe we ought to think a little bit bigger as we talk about legislation in the future.
So, Baron, do you want to comment?
Oh, I agree. I agree in two respects. One, that we should be talking about other things, and we're not going to as long as this fight is taking up all the oxygen in the room. And frankly, as long as this is a simple yes, no on net neutrality, I mean, having Republicans just say that net neutrality is the internet kill switch and is Obamacare for the internet is no less productive than is having Democrats falsely equate Title II regulation with net neutrality, right? And that dynamic is going to go on until we actually have something that forces us to actually resolve the issue. And maybe the CRA could do that. In other words, right now, the best thing that Republicans could do would be to say, I'm against the CRA, and instead I'm for Congress resolving this issue. Here's the legislation I'm for. Now, we've been critical of the Blackburn bill. It doesn't address some of the minimum things that need to be addressed. So just very briefly, so for example, even though the Blackburn bill grows out of the Waxman bill from 2010, and there's a basis for compromise there, it adds something else important, which is blocking the FCC from regulating under Title II. Once you start doing that, and you have to do that, it then opens up some other questions like, okay, well, if broadband isn't a telecommunications service, what about those provisions of the Act that are specific to telecommunications services? So the things that pertain to dealing with barriers to deployment are specific to telecommunications services. Universal service is as well. So in other words, one would have to go broader to actually resolve this issue and make sure that that this is a neat and tidy resolution. And the second way I'd agree with Gigi is I think there is a way to resolve this that is it is broader, that addresses larger issues. And for example, we haven't talked about interconnection, but there are other things that are not net neutrality themselves but are related to it that one might want to see as part of a legislative deal. And I would just say that there have been attempts in the past to hammer out a compromise on that. The one that we've talked about on this show before is my former think tank, the Progress and Freedom Foundation, back in 2004, 2005, convened people from across the political spectrum, mostly Democrats, in fact, people who were on Hillary's shortlist to be commissioners and appointees, Howard Schlansky, who ran the office of OIRA under the Obama administration. They sat down with people on the right to try to hammer out what would a 21st century FCC look like. And the compromise they came up with, the Digital Age Communications Act, the other DACA that everyone forgets now that we're talking about DACA for immigration, that was a way to go broader by saying we're not going to try to resolve everything in rules and statute. We're going to create standards that govern when the agency does case-by-case enforcement and when they do regulation. And that's just one model. And I'd very much like to have that conversation again. And unfortunately, again, that's not going to happen until the CRA is resolved. The sooner it is resolved, the more likely it is that we could actually come to a compromise this Congress. And if it doesn't get resolved this Congress, what I would suggest is that we start at the very beginning of the next Congress, especially if the Democrats take the House, because that might be a way to do a compromise, that we make this the first thing that gets done and stop kicking the can down the road, thinking that each time we get closer to an election, each side thinks, we might be in a better position next time. So let's not do any major deals. That's why Washington doesn't work.
Nobody is eager on my side of the aisle to have this conversation in this Congress. I mean, if John Thune's bill from 2014, 2015 is the gold standard, it really does not meet the standard, because it basically, it puts in place the bright line rule, so no blocking, no throttling, no paid prioritization, but it eliminates 706 authority, which of course the FCC has done as well, but eliminates the FCC's authority over broadband generally. I mean, if we can have a conversation about what the limits of the FCC's authority should be, but if the conversation begins and ends with the FCC shall have no oversight over the broadband market whatsoever and the FTC will take care and antitrust law will take care of everything, we have nothing to talk about. You know, look, I'll admit that, you know, Title II is the authority we have today, okay? You know, has it been updated for the broadband era? No, not really. Could it stand it? Yes. Okay, I mean, there's a reason why the FCC had to go to Title II to ensure that its net neutrality rules stood up in court, because there is no other authority. All right, so until Congress comes up with authority, and it's not enough to say no authority, it's got to be, yes, this is the agency that since 1934 has had oversight over networks. And we're not all of a sudden going to say, you know, 80 years later, the agency, which is the expert agency on networks, is going to have no oversight at all when it comes to access to the most important network of our lifetime. It's just, that doesn't make sense. I don't think the American people want it. The public interest community and Democrats will not go for it. So again, it depends on where you're starting and ending the conversation. Again, if an essential part of this conversation is FCC out, and it's going to be nothing more than a spectrum licensing authority or a place where you go to for complaints for robocalls, that's not going to be sufficient. And just to say, and this Barron knows very, very well, you know, I'm one of the people that spent an awful lot of money when I was the head of public knowledge in limiting the FCC's authority over technology. And the FCC does not have authority over the internet to the extent it doesn't have authority over search engines or social networks or Twitter, and it shouldn't. Okay, I've actually had people come up to me and say, well, shouldn't we expand the FCC's authority to deal with some of the competition issues with, you know, the big tech companies? And I say, absolutely not. Its expertise is in networks, but that's the way it's got to stay.
So let's unpack that for the audience. So the most important thing that Gigi did at Public Knowledge, in my opinion, was the broadcast flag case, which clearly established that the FCC's authority ends at communications. And that, you know, that should be apparent from looking at the statute, because that's what the statute says. But it took a court decision to say that, and good for her and Public Knowledge for getting that decision. But that still gives the FCC potentially a lot of wiggle room depending on what other grants of authority they claim. And so Section 706, for example, if it is a grant of authority, which we've always said it can't reasonably be interpreted to be, it means that the FCC can regulate any form of communications, not just broadband, in any way that it isn't specifically illegal. And though it's true that that wouldn't include, say, the search engine, but it's not actually clear where the line is. And for example, if we're talking about a VoIP service, right, that's been considered communications. And when you start thinking about the way that voice is now integrated into many internet services, I mean, actually, search, Alexa, there are other things that are now becoming more like VoIP services. It's not hard to imagine the FCC trying to regulate the communications aspects of those. That's why we think that Section 706 was never intended to be a grant of authority and has to be limited. We have other concerns about Title II I don't want to get into here, but I just want to say one thing to wrap up on this discussion of legislation. There was another path not taken here, which was the Clinton administration back in 93 and 94, their original vision for how to do what became the 96 Telecom Act had a Title VII. They were going to have a new title that the internet services were going to be put into over time. And that's essentially the road not taken here. That's what Senator Nelson meant when he's talked about having a Title X, right? That's where we should focus our attention. And the Thune bill, you know, Gigi noted, it actually would give the FCC authority to enforce all the bright line rules. So it's not accurate to say the FCC wouldn't have any authority. It would be more accurate to say the FCC would have the specific authority that Congress gave it and would not have a general roving authority over communications.
Yeah. So, I mean, that would not be adequate authority. Again, in some ways, we're agreeing that the FCC should have authority. The question is, what's the breadth of that authority? You know, I do not believe that our 2015 rules and forbearance allows for price regulation to the extent that the FCC, as it used to do in cable, could not set prices. Right? We got rid of every single mechanism for the FCC to do that. We forbore from all of that. Now, if Comcast decided to triple its prices tomorrow, could we, under the Section 201B standard, decide that it was unjust and unreasonable? Yes, but I think we should have that ability, okay? But these are the kind of conversations we can have. Okay, I'm not opposed to a Title X, But I'm certainly opposed to a Title X that gives the FCC, you know, no more authority than to enforce the bright line rules.
Okay, so we are all, three of us are lawyers, which is a nightmare of our previous host. So do you guys want to now chat about litigation?
Sure.
Because it will affect the congressional movement and the actions. Definitely, you can say that some of the members of Congress are waiting to see what happens in the courts first. Baron, you want to start us off?
Yeah, there's two tracks on litigation here. There's the current litigation that we're a part of. That's the challenge to the 2015 order. The government has continued to ask for extensions, and it appears that they will continue to do so. So in other words, the Supreme Court will apparently put off consideration of that issue until the final rule has been published in the Federal Register. At that point, I would predict that the government will simply ask for the case to be remanded back to the D.C. Circuit, and that would be a way of it would kick this back, and it would present the opportunity. This is not so easy, but it sort of presents the opportunity for this round of litigation, which by my count is the third round of litigation over the FCC's authority, to be effectively rolled in with the next round of litigation, the fourth round of litigation over Ajit Pai's Restoring Internet Freedom Order. That round of litigation will not begin until the rule has finally been published in the Federal Register. So you will see that round of litigation happen essentially in parallel with the Congressional Review Act. And basically what will happen is that GG and public interest groups will, on that side will ask, as opposed to public interest groups on our side, such as Tech Freedom, they'll ask for an injunction. They'll try to stop this from going into effect. And I think you'll see a relatively quick decision. They'll ask for expedited consideration. And so if you imagine that this that the order gets published in February or March or April, you'll see the thing go into effect 60 days later. The litigation will happen in the interim. I think it's exceedingly unlikely that that order would be struck down for the same reason that the FCC's won in the last two cases, which is Chevron deference. Thus far, the agency said, statute's ambiguous. We get deference in interpreting it. The FCC won on those arguments before. They'll win this time. The only thing they have to do this time that's a little different is they have to explain why they changed their minds. But the court's jurisprudence on that is pretty clear. You don't have to have a better reason for your new interpretation. You just have to have a reason for thinking the statute should be read differently. It's a pretty low bar. It's hard to see how the FCC would lose.
So, Gigi, I imagine like a Rocky montage of you getting ready for the litigation.
So a couple of things. So, again, the fact that the new order will not become effective until much further down the road, and probably much further down the road after the litigation becomes, I think makes a request for a stay, Baron use the term injunction, unlikely, right? Because the rules are still going to be in effect for quite some time. I mean, nobody's made a decision yet, but that's what it kind of looks like. I mean, we're going to be on several tracks here.
It'll be 60 days between publication and effectiveness, I think.
Well, again, that's tied. The effectiveness is tied to the OMB approval, and the litigation is not. Okay, this is the point I was making before that's extremely confusing. So the FCC actually can publish the summary, litigation can begin. And I think another interesting question with regard to litigation is, where is the case going to be heard? Which, you know, the D.C. Circuit is where we would like to go, but, you know, there were a bunch of preliminary protective filings filed about a week ago, and there was filings in the Ninth Circuit, there were filings in the First Circuit, so, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the D.C. Circuit. And another interesting little wrinkle, I know I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, was one of the key requests of the parties seeking certiorari of the ruling on the 2015 rules is that the court should vacate the U.S. telecom decision that upheld the 2015 rules. Yeah, so we'll have to see if the Supreme Court does that, right? Because that takes obviously a huge arrow out of our quiver in the litigation if that happens. So I agree with Baron to the extent that I think the agency has written a very strong order. And they get a great deal of deference under the Chevron case. And I've been a beneficiary of Chevron, and I've been screwed by Chevron. So sometimes I don't really know how I feel about Chevron. I will say, however, that the decision has some vulnerabilities. And the agency, I think the agency's process was less than perfect. Whether that's going to be enough to overturn the whole thing, I don't know. But I do think the biggest vulnerability, and they actually strengthen this point, or from my perspective, weaken this point in the final order as opposed to the draft that they circulated 3 weeks before they voted, was they basically said that broadband internet access is not doesn't even have a telecommunications component, right? Which is goes against the Brand X case, it goes against the U.S. Telecom case, it goes against the Verizon case. So while they get a lot of discretion, they still have to show that doing a 180 2.5 years later after the 2015 ruling was justified by the record, I think is going to be very difficult. It's not going to be a slam dunk. This is all to say, I don't think it's a slam dunk on either side. We feel good about our chances. But again, the prospect of Chevron is a very daunting one when you're challenging an agency's decision.
I'll tell you what, Gigi, if somehow the FCC loses, I will buy you an overcooked steak at the Trump Hotel. I might actually set foot in that building.
No,
I'm not going to.
You'll have to do takeout.
Yeah, neither of you, if you walk in, you'll both set on fire. No. And there's another front that this battle is fought at, which is the states. Gigi mentioned that a lot of states are passing legislation trying to. Montana, I believe, was the first one.
It's an executive order by the governor.
Yeah. Yes.
Nothing has been passed yet. There have been, if as I recall, Montana and New York, I believe, have issued executive orders by the governor saying that in order to get contracts with the state, companies have to certify compliance with their own set of net neutrality principles. There are also two bills pending in California, one of which would replicate the open internet order, and another one of which would take the same approach as those executive orders, plus also trying to say if you want to get a franchise, you want to get access to rights of way, you have to certify compliance with net neutrality orders. So they're different approaches, and some of those are obviously preempted by the FCC's open internet order, like the De Leon bill in California. I think the hardest things as a matter of federalism and preemption, which are two different issues, the hardest things are going to be the use of the state's purse, the spending power of the states, because states have a strong interest in how they spend their own money, right? And I would be the first to defend that in any circumstance. It's going to be a really interesting case to see what happens when those are challenged in court. And my prediction is that, again, things like replicating the order in regulation, that's clearly going to lose, not just because the FCC's preempted it, but because they're effectively trying to regulate an inherently interstate service. And that's especially true for mobile broadband, where you can get a plan in D.C., you go all around the country, you know, using the same plan. And if one state starts to regulate it, they're effectively regulating it for all states. That's not a preemption issue. That's a dormant commerce clause issue. The things in the middle, the use of state franchising of state assets, those look pretty much like the kinds of market entry barriers the FCC has been able to regulate to preempt in the past. The spending of state money, conditioning that on compliance with a set of regulations. That's the one that's going to be the most interesting to watch. I'm not really sure how that will turn out. There are good arguments to be made on both sides. But at the end of the day, it's worth noting that the states are being very open that this isn't really about spending their money more efficiently or even protecting their consumers. It's about trying to supersede federal action. And that's problematic for an inherently interstate medium to try to change the market. When you're changing the market, has an impact on services across the country. And the last thing I would say about it is, even if that's your best argument, ask yourself, what would Alabama do? Do you really want the governor of Alabama issuing an executive order or the state legislature passing laws that start to try to influence the market for services to prefer one outcome over another? Or maybe Texas. Texas has the scale to do that. I'm not sure we want to open that door.
So I guess my reaction is boo-hoo-hoo. I mean, you leave consumers unprotected, the states are going to come and fill a void. You know, I think it's interesting to point out that every time the ISPs challenge FCC action in this regard and win, it lands up being worse for them. So in 2008, under a Republican FCC chair, Comcast was told, you know, you cannot block uploads of peer-to-peer networks unless you've got a legitimate network management reason for it. So they, in my opinion, unwisely challenged that decision. They won. Okay, they won. Jedakowski went to rules. He went to rules that I thought were relatively weak. They were under Title I. Public knowledge when I was there defended them in court, even though we would have preferred a Title II solution. And because it was not a Title II solution, it got struck down by the courts. So Wheeler comes in, they do Title II. So it keeps getting worse for them. Here they had rules that were working. They were thriving. You know, it was really sort of sleeves off the vest. They challenge it and they win again. And what happens? The states want to fill a void. There's a whole bunch of other initiatives. Washington State's going to introduce a bill. Oregon's going to introduce a bill. Actually, the D.C. City Council just yesterday did a resolution of disapproval. It doesn't have any impact. But the point is, I think you're going to see more and more and more of these throughout the states. And do I agree with Barron that a federal solution is better than 50 different state rules? Absolutely. But you can't say, and as far the preemption aspect is, again, these rules are not in effect yet, right? So if anything does pass until the rules are in effect, then you'll start to see the preemption challenges, right? But you can't say we're going to essentially, you know, get rid of the protections or significantly weaken them if you believe the FTC, as I don't, really has the ability to protect consumers and competition in the space. If you can significantly weaken the protections federally, then it's really hard to for you to complain when the states try to fill the void. And it's similar with what AT&T proposed yesterday. So they took out huge ads in both the New York Times, Washington Post, wherever else, saying, you know, we got to get rid of this ping pong. Consumers need protection, you know, both from, you know, from us and from online platforms. So let's have an Internet Bill of Rights. And I was just like, okay, excuse me. You led the fight to get the broadband privacy rules repealed. You led the fight against, and you lead the fight against community broadband. You're leading the fight against net neutrality. So you've broken everything in a million pieces, and now you say you want to put it back together? Wrong messenger. Whatever you feel about long-term legislation, that is the wrong messenger for that message.
So, Barron, what do you think about AT&T's proposal?
My last word on this is that, look, all those issues were ultimately, fundamentally about the FCC's authority. That legal authority does matter. It will be used to the utmost. The promises of forbearance are meaningless in the long term. And ultimately, that's where AT&T was right, as to whether there should be separate standards for broadband, how we regulate the privacy for that versus the rest of the internet. I think we should have a consistent standard. I think the Federal Trade Commission is the cop on the beat for privacy and data security and other consumer protection issues, in addition to the states. And we should have a conversation about how the FTC works and what resources it needs, just as each state should be asking itself, what resources does their attorney general office have to handle these issues? And how are they going to coordinate with each other? There's a multi-state task force, for example, on antitrust cases. Right? That's a precedent that could be expanded. We could use that for digital consumer protection as well.
Thank you, Barron and Gigi, for joining us today. When your guests are such amazing experts that can run circles around anyone on the topic, all the host has to do is sit back, listen, and learn. Can't wait to have you back on the show.
Thanks.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom. Please leave us a review so others can find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.